FDF Awards. One of the most prestigious nights in the food and drink calendar is online 3rd of February. For details of this and other FDF events, including our online convention, visit our website, fdf.org.uk.
Hello. Welcome back to day two of the FDF convention. I'm Ian Wright. I'm the chief executive of the FDF. On day one of our convention, we looked at the issues of sustainability. We considered carbon net zero, healthy diets, plastics and packaging. In day two, we continue the focus on the longer term, but change tack a bit. First of all, we'll look at the issues of innovation and automation as we try and chart a way out of the crisis that COVID has created and look to the long-term future of the industry. We continue to look at the long term with a session on commercial focus and how the industry can grow. And finally, we look in detail at the way in which the devolved administrations of Scotland and Wales will help their local industries emerge from the crisis stronger and well supported. As ever with our convention, I want to thank our sponsors, Clark Energy and EIT, for their very generous support. I hope you enjoy your day.
My name's Jane Brookman and I'm Acting Director for the Northwest Regional Office of EIT Food and a sponsor of this event. EIT Food's a partnership of more than 85 of Europe's leading agri-food companies, research institutes and universities spanning the food supply chain. Our programme includes Rising Food Stars Association, which brings into our network many of Europe's best entrepreneurs, startups, and growing innovation-led companies. Our mission is to transform how food is produced and valued by European society. We do this through support for innovation, entrepreneurship, and education, working both for and with informed and engaged citizens. The subjects covered yesterday were topical and core to our work to deliver change for the food system. So we're very excited to see that today we've got an equally pertinent mixture of technology, commercial concerns and the importance of place, and I look forward to taking part in the discussions. If you'd like to know more about EIT Food and our knowledge and innovation community, please check out our website on eitfood.eu, or you can find us at Twitter on @EITFood, or just contact me directly. I do hope you enjoy the day, and thanks to FDF staff for putting together such an interesting programme.
I'm Helen Munday. I'm the FDF Chief Scientific Officer. One of my areas of responsibility is innovation, and so I'm delighted this morning to be introducing a panel of expert speakers to you who are going to help us understand this topic of immediate needs for an automated and digitised future. As I look at our industry, I see a real breadth of companies, some of which are at the cutting edge of understanding the potential of these areas, and others who probably a little bit bemused by what the opportunity is for them to get hold of. And I'm hoping and expecting, and I know it'll happen, that these fine experts in the field will help us understand a little bit more about that. So without any further ado, you can see our contributors today. We have Keith Thornhill, who's with Siemens. We have Ben Ramsden, who's with the Digital Catapult, Ben Rosick with Omron, and Mike Wilson with the MTC. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, and so that they don't have to explain too much more about who they are, you can find all of their biographies on the website where we talk about the convention, the content for today. So we'll let you do that in your own time. As a framing, I'm asking each of the panelists to think about how they and their organisations are working with businesses like those who are FDF members to realise an automated and digitised future. So if I can pass over to Keith.
Yeah, thanks, thanks, Helen, and thanks the FDF for inviting me to this forum today. So my name's Keith Thornhill and I head up the food and beverage business for Siemens UK and Ireland. It is a strategic focus for Siemens, the sector of food and beverage or food and drink globally. And I think that identifies, if we like Siemens, the potential in the sector to automate and digitalise processes. It's really interesting, actually. And our pedigree is factory automation. That's where people will, a company will recognise the name Siemens in a factory. These are the control systems that are controlling the machines and the processes. And of course, that is still key to what we do with a lot of food companies. But the game is changing significantly, and this is down to digitalization and the extra value add that now comes through connecting assets and connecting processes together. So data is becoming the big driver, and this is the sort of area now we're really developing relationships, because it has to be a collaborative approach. So that the idea of a supplier-buyer relationship, I think, is now moving to more collaborative, because it's only through collaboration you really start to get the most out of everybody's expertise. So that's definitely something that that we're working on. And, you know, through whether it's obsolescence, upgrading, you know, a lot of automation in the sector already, but a lot of it is 1970s, 1980s automation. So there's an element of obsolescence upgrade, but then it's connecting, it's visualizing the data, and importantly, it's the insights then that comes from that connected data that develops the business improvement processes.
So perhaps, Mike Wilson, you could introduce yourself now.
At the Manufacturing Technology Centre, the MTC, we're fundamentally about trying to help companies adopt new technologies, be it automation or digital technologies. And we do that in two ways. It's firstly by providing independent advice and support for those companies that need it in terms of identifying what the best solutions would be for their manufacturing operations, and also providing assistance in terms of the softer issues, things like training and the assimilation of those technologies into their businesses. And then the second aspect that we do is about innovation. So it's about developing new technologies or working with the equipment and the technology vendors to develop their technologies to ensure that they're appropriate for UK manufacturing businesses. As Keith mentioned, the food and beverage sector is an important sector in the UK, and it's important to us as well. So it's an area that we have particular focus, and we're advising quite a number of companies in that space now adapt and adopt new automation and digital technologies to improve their manufacturing capabilities.
And let's move on then to Dan.
Yeah, it's a delight to be here. So I'm honoured to be part of the panellists. I work for Omron. We're a technology vendor. For many years now, we've been working with a sort of diverse range of food and beverage manufacturers, everything from SMEs all the way up to sort of multi-site, multi-region, blue-chip organisations. We work in partnerships with machine builders and a certified system integrator network. And really, our role is to help and support manufacturers overcome their business and manufacturing challenges by leveraging our automation technologies. And these include things like robotics, data accumulation, integration systems, machine control, inspection, smart sensing and safety systems, to name but a few. But yeah, really looking forward to the panel session today.
Thanks very much, Dan. And finally to Ben.
So Digital Catapult, we're sister catapult to the Manufacturing Catapult, MPC, and there's nine other catapults in the wider network. We focus on digital, and our kind of purpose is to enable the early adoption of advanced digital technologies. So by that, that's everything from kind of data quality through Internet of Things, data infrastructure like 5G to enable robotics and so on. And then looking at process optimization and prediction for artificial intelligence, machine learning, machine vision, and so on. And then beyond that, looking at unlocking the new economic business models that can be delivered through this kind of digitally connected world that Keith was talking about, using blockchain and distributed systems. And ultimately, there's so much data out there. How do we better visualize it and better experience the data, whether it be for monitoring production efficiency or training? And we can use things like augmented, mixed and virtual realities for that. We deploy all of this in kind of four key ways. So there's like a because traditionally our work has been in aerospace and defence, and I came in over the last 18 months or so to develop the strategy for food and drink. And top level is we look on a systems-wide approach. So how can we work with things like organisations like the Food and Drink Sector Council and others to unlock a kind of tipping point across the sector and the programme we're putting together with high-value manufacturing, satellite applications, the agri-tech centres and others is for Feed UK. I'm looking at creating a national digital data infrastructure to enable the effective flow of information across the system. All of it based on the hypothesis or the kind of the market failure that because information doesn't flow across the food system or any manufacturing supply chain, products and money are wasted. And as a result, society and the environment are paying the price. So we also do, to support that, we also do collaborative research and development programs, specific one being the digital sandwich, where we're looking at digitalizing all of the end-to-end processes using the kind of the principles that I just and technologies that I just talked about across the sandwich supply chain. And a whole lot of the programs, whether it's looking at risk and live risk management across the chain and looking at business continuity risk, fully digitally optimized and automated factories, and then through the bespoke work we do, so commercial work, we develop kind of bespoke solutions. On top of things like the accelerator, so we're just running the Made Smarter Technology Accelerator at the moment, just launching, where we're looking at specific challenges over the next 12 months to really drive digital adoption across the sector.
Thanks. Yes. Sorry. It's a little ironic, isn't it? We're talking about technology, and I'm in a very rural area, in one of those spots that the government always talks about. and the farmers around here don't get 4G, let alone 5G. Anyway, that's another problem. So thank you very much for doing that introduction. And it also reminds me that I think in our sector, the automation part of this discussion is probably a lot more obvious to us as food and drink manufacturers than potentially the digitization bit. And I suppose automation, you can see it, can't you? I mean, you can see a production line, you can see where a robot is doing something rather than 15 people. But the data and things like data trust and various other things, that's all a bit more difficult to get your head around. So I wonder if each of you would like to maybe describe the opportunities for food and drink to really bring this topic to life for our delegates today.
Yeah, so I go first, I guess. You're right. You know, digitalization is an interesting word, and it conjures up everything from probably somebody's laptop to some really 5G connectivity. You know, so it's trying to position that in a way that you can articulate the value, and that is often a challenge. But ultimately, I think we do get hung up with the words, the buzzwords. And I can go back, you know, a few years back when we started talking about Industry 4.0 and, you know, the evangelists out there, you know, and we were sort of preaching to everybody that this is the next big thing. And you could tell it was just going over the top of everybody, you know. But interestingly, the language now is being played back to us. So it's resonated. So companies are talking about, I want a smart factory. I want horizontal data connectivity from SAP right down to the gearbox on the shop floor. They want that. There's positions that are starting to take place in companies, digital transformation officers, digital and automation directors. So these are the positions in place because where the big difference is between the OT or the production environment and the IT. And when that links together, that's when the value really starts to go through. But that's a challenge because it's often different operating systems, it's different software. And so that's where there's quite a lot of companies now that are really focusing on that IT-OT space, pulling real-time data off the production. So connect the production lines, understand why their lines are stopping. if you connect them together, you can visualize what's going on. You can then interpret the root cause analysis of why the lines are stopping, because often big stops are obvious. Small stops are the things that kill OEE, but very difficult to work out why there's a small stop, many, many small stops a day. So that's what digitalization to me, I interpret it as, it's connecting things together. It's getting that insight to continuously improve your process. You then can start thinking about digital twins, simulation, whether that's simulating the process, the machine, whether it's simulating the fluid flow within the pipes to optimize performance. All this is achievable as point solutions. But to me, the big piece is when we link things together and we start to get the insight, whether that's artificial intelligence or whatever other buzzword you want to try and use. But ultimately, it's a continuous improvement process. It's what and digitalization is just another set of tools that allows us to deliver that business improvement.
Yeah. Mike, do you want to expand on that? And just before you do, please do remember those who are watching, we would love to pose your questions to the panel. So please do put those into the question box. Mike.
Thanks, Helen. So I completely agree with Keith in terms of the benefit of digital technologies and the benefit of linking everything together and gaining the data from it. But I want to go back a couple of steps, if I may, because my main focus is the automation side. And I'm going to refer back to something Keith mentioned in his introduction. Unfortunately, in a lot of our factories, we're using out-of-date automation technologies. And that generates its own challenges. And I do think we need to try and make our facilities as productive as we possibly can. And that requires investment, not only in digital technologies, but also in current automation technologies. So greater use of robots, for example. And in the UK, for some reason, we're different to the rest of the world. So I'm not going to bore everybody with lots of statistics, but the International Federation of Robotics produces a stat, which is robot density. It's the number of robots per 10,000 workers. And in the UK, we're currently 24th in the world, and we're below the world average. We are out of step with what the rest of the world is doing. Now, that's generally across manufacturing, but food and drink is also the same. It's a pattern that we have across all of UK manufacturing. And if we're going to be truly competitive going forward, we need to try and address that. And I think some of it is down to perceptions. People believe the technology is expensive. They believe it's difficult to use. And therefore, they're kind of avoiding it. And that's really where organizations like ours, the MTC, is there to help them. Because it's not expensive anymore. It's not as difficult as it used to be. It is more applicable than it used to be, and more companies should be doing it. And I think we need to address both the digital side and the automation side at the same time. Because if people are afraid of one technology, they will also be afraid of any technologies. And I think it's, if you like, now is probably the time where UK manufacturing is starting to realize that things need to be different. You know, one of the benefits of the COVID pandemic, if there are any benefits, is I think it's made people realize that they need to do things differently, and they are investigating how it can be done. But it's very important that we do more than just investigate. We need to make some positive steps. We need to start introducing these technologies and improve the productivity of all of our factories, and particularly in food and drink, largely because it's the biggest manufacturing sector we've got in the UK. And to make it more productive is going to be a benefit to everybody. And I just want to throw in one other point very quickly. This is not about taking jobs away. This is about removing the arduous, the mundane, the unpleasant tasks, and reusing the people on places where they add value to the product, rather than just physically moving things around. And there are still lots of opportunities within food and drink to utilize robots and automation systems on those relatively simple, mundane, repetitive tasks, and use the people we've got where they can be much more productive with more interesting jobs and probably better paid jobs as well.
Yeah, good, very, very good point. Dan, as someone who works on the equipment side of things, what do you see as the opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's very easy to become overwhelmed by the technology and terminology. And, you know, in the end, it is all technology, whether it's digitalization, robotics or automation. I think the fundamental factor really is to identify what the business challenge is for specific manufacturers. Often manufacturers start with the technology and try to drive that into their business operation. But there are any sort of macro factors, you know, whether it's things like unplanned stoppages, whether it's workforce density, whatever those challenges are within that organization. The most productive factor is to identify what those are and then identify whether there's a solution through technology, whether that's digitalization, automation, robotics, or whatever.
Thanks, Dan. And Ben? And I can see we've got some questions starting to come in, so that's great. We'll come to those shortly.
So I guess from my side, I mean, so when I've been out in both in the UK and internationally, when you speak to factory owners and manufacturers about, you know, what they see as the opportunity. And if we really simplify it, it's like, why do my children run their social lives with better technology than I run my business? And, it, you know, the level of complexity behind the technology that's available for consumers is deep, but the usability of it is extremely simple. And so there's a big challenge for the kind of technology community to be able to make sure that the technology that is already functioning is going to work effectively for the manufacturers, and that its adoption is done in as simple is an effective way as possible. There's much more trust required in how you manage your business and the kind of networks which feed your business than it is for your children to run their social lives. But we can't. So there's a much more complex environment to engage in. But in terms of the opportunities when we get there, because it is going to happen, you know, we've got some kind of principles around the enabling conditions that we're going to need around effective governance of the system, the right permissioning and privacy sharing kind of systems and the need for greater interoperability. And ultimately that we've got to have the right incentives for participation. But once those are in place, what we've started to see is real gains on kind of three principal levels. And that's on, first of all, is the kind of process optimization. And we're seeing in some projects 10% increase in productivity. We're seeing, and others, there's when you look end to end, there's also almost 30% gains that can be made across procurement, across end-to-end supply chain, when we take, and that's really looking at physical and digital interoperability and really looking at, you know, quite significant changes to business kind of operations, but there's huge benefits that can be generated from process optimization piece. Then we're looking at improvement, as a result of that, mainly looking at resource use, up to 70% reduction in waste. And then once we're able to really look at the kind of validity of the data, so long as the data is really high quality and we can be confident about the benefits, we start to there's one program we're working on where we're starting to see 100% assurance around claim validation and verification, so that we know that if the data is in the system, it's true, and that can deliver a step change in food safety, and when you connect that into financing, We're starting to look at potential gains of 50% gains in working capital. You know, 50% reduction in costs for working capital because of the veracity of the claims that are made on through the systems. So the combination of all of this is that there's huge gains that can be made for businesses and those that are willing and ready to kind of start to participate. But we're not quite there in terms of the enabling conditions and the usability of the tech.
Which I think brings us perfectly on to the next question that I had, and that some of the those who are watching us also have. So my next question was, what do you see as the barriers for stepping over the threshold into this future for our sector? And we have a couple of questions from the audience, which I think is very similar. Can I ask if poor take-up of robotics in the UK food and drink sector is mainly at SME level, or is it across the board? And then someone else saying, I work for an SME, and the cost of initiation is a barrier. Where do the panel think cobots fit into an org? It must be robots, I think. Fit into an organic technology integration. And I'm more than happy for whoever would like to pick up this barriers question to do that.
Can I start with that one, Helen, just as I'm
sure.
Very much in the robot space. In terms of barriers, I mentioned a couple. Some of it's about perception. Some of it's about cost. Perception in terms of the skills or the complexity of the equipment. And a lot of that is no longer true. It's easier to use. It's not as expensive as people think. Some of it is about identifying the right solutions. So working with either independent advisors or working with the supply chain to find the most appropriate solution to a particular problem. And the cobot question is collaborative robots. It's just a shortened term. But the point there is, yes, cobots are applicable. It's about using them in the right places, though, because cobots in general are slower and cannot carry as much as a normal industrial robot, principally because of the safety issues surrounding their adoption. And you need to risk assess the actual application, not just the robot itself, to ensure that the whole solution is safe. But they do have their place, and they are generally easier to use. They're not necessarily lower cost, but they're easier to use and apply than maybe an industrial robot. But I would argue that in every case, we should look at every individual application and identify the most appropriate solution for that particular application. And it may be that an industrial robot is the right answer rather than a cobot. But the cobots also potentially provide more flexibility, and they're potentially lower cost overall because you don't have the same guarding requirements around the machine itself. So it can make them more appropriate in certain applications. There was a question in the middle of all of that in terms of SMEs versus the larger businesses. And I think in the main, the initial introduction of robots has been in the larger businesses, particularly those that have global operations, because they're bringing the same technologies into the UK as they're using in other facilities in other parts of the world. If you take Nestle as an example, irrespective of whether it's a UK plant or a plant in anywhere else in the world, they'll pretty much apply the same kind of technologies. Whereas an SME often is UK only, and therefore is basing what they do on the local situation. But there are quite a few SMEs that have put robots in and found them very successful. It's about doing the early steps of the project right. And one of the things that can now be done, it's not been available for long, as it were, is leasing of equipment. We've been trying to do leasing of equipment for years, and it's always been difficult with robot and automation solutions. You can do it with cars, you can do it with forklift trucks, you can do it with machine tools, where you can now do it with robots and other forms of automation. And that makes the equipment much more viable from a financial perspective. And often, if you're looking at a robot system and you lease it over 5 years, you can get a return, as in cash into the business, the day you turn it on, because the savings that you get outweigh the cost of the lease. So it becomes much more financially acceptable from that point of view. And I don't want to spend too long on this, but the key to all of this is about getting the right advice, whether it's an industrial robot, whether it's a cobot, whether it's automation, to get the right solution to meet the needs of your particular application.
Thanks, Mike. And I think that touches on another question that has come in around the investment on automation, and that it's not always easy to persuade shareholders to invest in this sort of thing, because the return on assets may take a considerable time. But the leasing bit is a really interesting point. So is there anyone else who'd like to come in on this question?
Yeah. I mean, from my point as well, I totally agree with Mike's point there. And I think the landscape on the different business models is changing. And I think that's down to, as you start to be more understanding of your particular asset that you're putting forward, you get more experience of when it's potentially going to fail, when it's going to stay up. So, and so you're starting to see more as a service type model. So rather than buy the actual asset or the capital, you're buying the performance of what that's delivering. And of course, you can be paid on packs per minute or gallons per second or whatever your filling rate is. But so this is all down to the fact that you've got the OEMs or the machine builders or the robot suppliers have got the data to actually wrap it up into some sort of service model rather than a capital. So again, you know, that's it takes the aggravation away of keeping the asset up to date, because that's taken care of by the machine builder. And so for upgrades, it's always never in obsolescence. It's always in. So you're paying for the service of the product rather than the capital. So that's something that is absolutely changing. But ultimately, I think what stumbles a lot of companies is not having the vision to actually drive their business in a particular way. To Ben's point previously, you know, we're inundated with all sorts of technology, but most plants seem to be immune to the technology revolution that happened back in the 1600s and in places. You know, so these are the sort of things that we're not immune to it. Factories are seeing things taking place. But the important thing is to have that culture. If you've got the culture of wanting to be the best, wanting to be at the forefront of activity, then you're going to have a customer base that is desperate for your product, as opposed to spiraling to the lowest cost. And ultimately, there's only one end in that game, you know. So I think there's a piece there that we as technology providers have to articulate the benefits better. And to get those return investments to a position where it is more attractive. But at the same time of all of this, Jim, we saw the labour pressures that are on at the moment, whether it's the Brexit discussion of not having the labour available to facilitate some of these processes. That burning platform tends to focus the mind with most company. And we've absolutely seen in relatively largest UK companies doing food to go products where they've had to bus their shifts across the country to satisfy a particular shift pattern, literally busing, you know, 50-100 people around the country just to make sure that they can make that particular product on the day. That is not sustainable, and the only option for that is to automate the process. So, you know, we see that's the burning platform that forces companies to look at it, but the better way is not be reactive, it's better being preactive, and you can then start to drive that vision and put it into place.
And maybe I can throw something more into this, which has come as one of the other questions, and this is probably something that Ben can certainly pick up on, is that someone's asking, what incentives do you think retailers and or government need to think about to accelerate the adoption of food and drink companies to invest and take the risk of change? And maybe this feeds into your Feeds UK project then.
Yeah, that's perfect complimentary thing. Yeah, no, that's great. Because so
you can base the question for that one.
Because I think building on what both Mike and Keith have been saying is, you know, there's a new kind of infrastructure that's ready now for deployment across the sector. And that infrastructure, both physical through robotics and automation and kind of digital, is the offers a new business models which can require mindset shift really to be able to embrace. And the real gains for these are when we look end to end. I mean, there's obviously huge gains when you're optimizing your processes within the confines of your own business model, but where companies really have opportunity for unlocking significant gains, the ones that I mentioned primarily, is when you go end to end. And this is lines up to the kind of trends around resilience and also greater sophistication with consumers around wanting to understand the provenance of products and the the standards that products are made in. And so this new environment that companies are working in is being accelerated by the challenges around Brexit and climate change and, you know, what other challenges are on their way. So there is now much more of a focus from government and from the big retail and from kind of big commercially powerful entities to be able to start to look at more longer term strategic relationships across their supply chains. So this kind of mindset shift is really important. The big challenge that we have is obviously power dynamics across supply chains and the kind of historical mistrust that people have. And there really needs to be, you know, as I mentioned previously, the governance, the permissioning, the interoperability, these are kind of fundamentals that need to be looked after. And then the other one is around the incentives. So what incentives? So whether we're looking at environmental land management scheme on the agricultural side or just generally net zero targets, there are fundamentally the key driver is that we want to be what governments and retailers care about now is not just about input data, but outcomes. So there's a whole shift now towards outcomes and measuring, better measuring outcomes, which means you can better measure performance. And so ultimately, there are incentives that we're seeing it with the environmental land management scheme, that the public payments for public good, and starting to look at payments for outcomes. And so for better performance. And so what that does is give us the ability to monetize the data. So previously, you know, up to now, the most secret source of a business is generally seen as its data. Well, it's there's a new paradigm where data, as Keith mentioned earlier, becomes a massively valuable asset for a company. And so the key is that we need to be able to work with industry to be able to find a way to best kind of create the incentives for monetizing their data and optimizing their processes. So I don't know if I'm rabbiting on a bit, but ultimately the digital and the automation infrastructure that's able to be deployed now can create a new business model for companies where it aligns to the kind of strategic priorities of government and industry to deliver these incentives that we need for process optimization and net zero. And with Feed UK, what we're looking at is ultimately we need a data utility, which is we have roads, we have sewage systems, et cetera, but we need a data utility, which is there to both basically provide the core infrastructure that would enable this data sharing at scale across the industry and the creation of national digital twins and so on. But it has to first of all meet the needs of each individual company entering data into the system. So I don't want to rabbit on too much, but basically that's the kind of environment that we can be operating in. And in order to overcome these barriers, we need to work together as kind of as a community to start to ensure that the needs of industry are met.
Thanks, Ben. And Dan, I've got a question just come in that I think might be a good one for you. But if you want to answer the previous question, then please do. But the one that's just come in is, currently my company produces over 1,000 different product lines and over 75 pack sizes. Is automation only for single line focused production lines?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's quite common. And as long as you start at the beginning to when you do your system design, your proof of concept, your feasibility study, if you consider the range of flexibility and agility you need from the manufacturing system or the production system that you're designing, it can cope with that level of variation. And it's quite common for people like contract packers where they're producing low to medium volume, very high product mix. but you have to identify that at the start of your project and design that into your system to have capacity to cope with that type of flexibility. So it's not just for high volume production lines. Automation systems, especially robotics, have intrinsic flexibility, but you need to identify that at the start. And that's often the challenge, where it's not identified at the start, and then you've got a system that's been designed which can't cope with that required flexibility. But like I said, identify at the start, smart design of machines, and you can build in that flexibility.
Sorry, I was just going to add something to that as well around adaptability and machinery. And I think, you know, even that game's changing in as much that, you know, some of the companies in the US now are thinking about, well, more than thinking about actually delivering personalised nutrition products. So almost in the pharma scale, but it's food products, but nutritionally balanced to that individual. So you're thinking of that customization, but the only way you're going to do it in a cost-effective way is to do it in a production environment. So that means almost the SKU is being developed on the fly as it's coming down the production line. So where at the moment you have a set number of recipes and a net set number of SKUs, it could be going forward that the SKU is infinite because it's going to be personalised at the very end. Now that is at the extreme of agility, but that is the nature of what's going to be happening, and therefore fixed production lines are going to be probably a thing of the past. But you almost want adaptive lines that move around and create their own lines for that particular product on that particular day, and then they restructure themselves to the next product because that's a different type of pack, fill, label system. But because it's all connected, it can just move around and join together to create that particular line. So I think it's an interesting point, but the machine builders are part of this discussion as well, and they have to come up with these great ideas and designs that's going to, you know, cope with this adaptability that's going to be required.
Anyone else want to come in on that point about?
Just a quick comment, Helen, if I may. I mean, I've got a great example of that. It's something that we're doing at the MTC currently. So we have a development project that's looking at vision guidance to robots for picking things to feed into an assembly process. And the vision system is not taught, and the robot is not taught in the same way that you would do normally with a fixed program. It's been given the intelligence whereby you can put, let's say, a bunch of plastic parts in front of it, and it will identify the one that it can pick first and pick it and feed it onto the process. And we demonstrated the flexibility of it recently purely by taking the plastic parts away, filling the bowl with strawberries, and letting the robot pick the strawberries. So it went from plastic parts to strawberries without any additional programming or instruction. And as we develop those kind of technologies, it gives us that ultimate in terms of flexibility.
Thanks very much. So if I may, the title of this session is Immediate Needs for an Automated and Digitized Future. We've obviously talked quite a bit about the future as we see it, but I suppose there's two big things that are happening right now, or one of them's happening right now, one of them's going to happen in about 4 weeks' time, and that's the final removal of the UK from the EU, and that will certainly have implications on movement of labour into the UK. We have the COVID-19 pandemic, both things which have impacted the way that production facilities are and are likely to be run in the future. Do you see this as being something of a tipping point which helps mitigate some of these risks around the lack of labour or not wanting to put team members at risk in factory environments? Anyone like to take that one?
Do you mind if I kick off, Helen? It's very true.
Yeah.
You know, it's providing a significant incentive or impetus, if you like, to encourage people to look at automation solutions, because we can't just throw labor, if you like, at the problem anymore. We need to think of different ways of doing it. So the ability to put robots into the production line, or to put cobots into the production line, to actually spread the workers out. So as I mentioned earlier, is let's use the robots, cobots for the mundane, the repetitive tasks, and use the people where they're going to add value to the product. And if we can spread the people out so we get more distance between the workforce by using robots to perform some of the tasks, we give our businesses more resilience. We don't become as dependent on having hundreds of people in the factory. We can use the automation. I don't think we'll ever get to the point where we're fully automated, at least not in my lifetime. But to me, it's about utilizing people as effectively as possible and using the robots to help perform the tasks, but also to give us more more resilience in the face of issues like the pandemic that we're going through at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing is kind of the strategic planning kind of phases of companies have been massively shortened. So what was you've got your immediate planning, your medium and your long-term plans. And what we're seeing is that cycle has been massively shortened. And the stuff that was on the distant horizon is now very much in the future. I mean, an example being kind of digital audit virtual audit. And as starting to be a real priority for companies, starting because obviously there's huge costs associated to audit and verification of claims. And in many cases, it could be based on data that could be a lot better than it currently is. So that's one example of an area where there's massively shortened horizons. But generally, yeah, I think that, you know, the as mentioned earlier, that we've got Brexit, we've got the COVID pandemic, but also climate change, net zero, and then the future challenges that are going to come from that, is really making people understand that it's the time's now to embrace these new opportunity.
From my point of view, I mean, you know, COVID has brought the future probably 10 years sooner than it would have happened, and we can just see the devastation of the high street and what impact that has, and there's no way that isn't going to end up having some impact in food manufacturers. Some have been crazily busy through this process, and others have basically had to close up because there was no outlet for their products if it was basically on the high street or airports or whatever. But the food to go, I think, or convenience foods had a struggle through this. But of course, the ones with the frozen foods, the canned foods, the longer shelf life foods of they can't make enough. All have got different challenges, and this turbulence is what the companies are sort of using it as a way of, well, let's not just keep on spending capital at something that we're not too sure where we're going. What we're seeing is the ability to sort of draw a line under the sand and not just keep on going the way we have done. Let's use this time to really plan where this position needs to be, this business needs to be in the next 5 or 10 years. And the importance of the technology and the automation is going to play a part in that. So we're seeing a bit of a holding pattern while these companies are making a decision. But ultimately, it's utilizing their knowledge, their domain knowledge of their processes, aligned with the technology and the sort of low risk way of going through the MTC or the Digital Catapult or the Lincoln University or Sheffield Hallam. These universities designated to be supporting the food industry. There's low cost ways of actually getting innovation into your business and help sort of plan that vision. So that's what we're seeing, is that yes, there's here and now activity, business as usual stuff, but actually a lot of companies are using this time well to actually plan where they're going, and then we'll spend according to that new vision.
I'm always quite interested to see what are the words of the year, and obviously COVID has been one of them, but I'm sure pivot has to be another one too, because everyone's talked about pivoting the way they do things. And I've got to imagine that it's actually easier to pivot with a bit of kit than it is with a whole workforce that needs to be retrained. And the example of the flour manufacturers having to go from the 20 kilo bags to the 1.5 kilo bags for all us home bakers, and I'm making my bread in my in Marvin right now. That is absolutely typical, isn't it? We've all done it in some ways, but for food and drink, it's probably been highly impactful. So thank you. I think one of the questions that's also come is, and it's a bit where we started off as well, I think people can see why they would want to do it. They can understand the benefits of doing it, but they just really have the trouble to get their hands around, how can I do it? You just mentioned about the MTC. I mean, do we have demonstrators? Do we have ways that people can really get this, you know, right between the eyeballs and really get it?
Yes, Helen, is the short answer. It's please engage with the catapults, either the digital catapult, the high value manufacturing catapult, as Keith mentioned, Lincoln or Sheffield Hallam Universities. All of us are here to help. And at the Manufacturing Technology Centre, for example, we do have equipment. We can demonstrate what that equipment can do. We can build specific pilots or demonstrators for companies to show them how the equipment would work within their particular facilities, doing the kind of tasks that they want to do. Obviously, that's not all free. You know, there has to be, you know, some costs associated with it. But by helping companies early, and, you know, I think, you know, Dan mentioned it earlier on, by doing the work up front and doing the study early, you can make sure that what you install, what you invest in, meets your needs today and for the future. And therefore, investment early in the project will save you an awful lot of money or reduce the risk of wasting money much later in the project. So it's worthy spending the time and the money to invest in the studies to get the solutions right. And we're here to help do that.
I think from our perspective, I think like most technology vendors, we have a proof of concept centre based in Milton Keynes where we can perform robotic feasibility studies and automation feasibility studies. And yeah, to reiterate what Mike said, you know, that should be the first step, is identifying what the challenges you're looking to overcome and progressing with a feasibility study to identify, one, if it's achievable, two, what the cost might be, and also then you can start calculating what your return investment might be, and that gives you the case to move forward with a business case back to your business.
Just to, again, to add to that, I mean, with the digital tools now as well, we're on virtual reality, you can demonstrate what this new investment is going to look like before you commit to the capital, you know, so you can start to run the what if scenarios. What if my capacity goes up 10%? Can it withstand that? You know, what's the look and feel of it? You know, you're not buying into it, fitting it, and then finding it's not quite doing what it was intended to, or you've got connectivity issues. You can do a lot of that stuff now in the virtual. So again, getting there early engagement, engage the people who've got the knowledge of the technology, with understanding of where the end manufacturer is aiming to go, and then you can produce those digital twins, and they can make a decision on whether is it best to go with two robots, one robot, is it better to stay with human? You can do all that virtually before you commit to going down that route, so it de-risks the whole expenditure of the capital.
I'm very conscious of time. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I know you're about to say something, Ben, but maybe you can make it kind of your summary statement as well as the point you were going to make. Would that be okay? And I'm going to go around everyone just to make, you know, their takeaway from this session.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so I guess the building on what Mike was saying, I mean, we don't compete with the market, we want to move it forward. And the facilities and the resources that we have at our disposal, which are considerable in the Catapult network, are basically here for industry. So What I would be very keen on is if companies were interested in the kind of embracing this digital journey to get in touch, whether it's around testing programs in our facilities, collaborating on CR&D projects, so accessing government funding for testing programs and so on, or participating in the wider Feed UK program. If it's not right for us, we would then connect people into the right sort of companies, but who would be able to deliver that. But the key message, I think, is that there is an enormous new kind of digital infrastructure that is coming to market. And those companies that are able to embrace it and develop the new business models, we believe, are going to be the ones that are going to be winning in the future. So it's best not to wait too long to start this journey.
Thanks, Ben. Keith?
Yeah, I think it's a good discussion today. We've been preaching to the converted, certainly on the panel, I think, which would be interesting to see how it's taken outside in reality world, I guess. But for me, you know, it's important to get that vision of where the factory needs to go. You know, it's never been easier to actually engage with companies, to actually, you know, work with them to actually develop some solutions, whether and also the infrastructure around the catapults and the universities to utilise Innovate UK where you can. We've got some great projects going through Hallam at the moment around self-adapting machinery, you know, through Innovate UK funding. So it's a low risk way of doing that. But to Dan's point earlier, it's about early engagement. It's about understanding what's trying to be achieved. Don't get too hung up on the technology or the words. It's just tools that's going to assist the process. And I think that's to me is the important takeaway.
Thanks. Dan, few words?
Yeah, I found the topics really interesting. Nothing out of the expectation, though, and it's quite interesting that the challenges that we speak to day on day to manufacturers have been reiterated in this session. But then the challenges that can be overcome by engaging with the, you know, the catapults, technology vendors, system integrators, there's nothing really particularly overwhelming that can't be achieved. Really interesting session. Glad to have taken part in it, and I hope everyone found it useful.
I'm sure they did. Mike, your closing remarks.
I think, you know, we've said an awful lot, and I hope it chimed with people's views in the audience. You know, I would stress today is not the time to kind of think that we can just keep doing what we've always done. We need to do things differently. And we do appreciate that for many people that can be a challenge. You know, there are things they have to learn. And as Ben mentioned, you know, the catapult, you know, we in the Manufacturing Technology Centre, we're here to help. So please, you know, reach out to us. We can help. We can give you the starting point, if you like, and set you on the direction you need to go. And we work with you. It's not about us telling you what to do. It's about listening to your needs and identifying how best we can help you move down that journey.
Thanks, Mike. And to summarise, I would also say that, you know, our panel today are all people that we talk to regularly. We are working with our members through our industrial strategy growth team to, to really bring this to life for our members, and this is something that is a red hot topic for us, and we really want to start accelerating our understanding of this, but getting it into factories even more than has been the case. And we know that some do this brilliantly already, but it's getting everyone to where they need to be for the future. So I'd really like to thank you for your time today, panel. That's been really interesting from my perspective. I hope from those who have been attending as well. And thanks again to the sponsors who are also active on this topic with us. And we hope to see you for future panels later on today and at FDF events in the future. So thanks very much, everyone. Goodbye for now.
FDF Awards, one of the most prestigious nights in the food and drink calendar, is online 3rd of February. For details of this and other FDF events, including our online convention, visit our website, fdf.org.uk. FDF, passionate about food and drink.